But this time, the topic, the challenge of missions in Africa, will be presented by Dr. Huffman, our treasurer, on behalf of the World Missions Council, to present this topic. Dr. Huffman.
Do we have to have all this junk in front of us here? Is that so? I see there were still Lutherans in this place. Everybody sitting in the back rows back there. We Lutherans believe in the literal application of that passage. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God. Than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. Well, I recommend these tents of wickedness around the front here, and I would appreciate it if some of you would just come on down here without wasting any time. Very much. Come right on down. All of the arrangements for these two appearances were made by long distance telephone to Seward when I was up there a couple of weeks ago, and it's probably my responsibility that I got the two mixed up, but I thought you wanted to show slides in the evening, and the only ones I've got are of the Far Eastern trip I made this summer. I've just come back from Africa. In fact, I was in Africa on Monday of this week, and I preached in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, on Sunday morning in the Amharic service there before a crowded congregation of at least 600 or 650. Amharic Christians that belong to the Mekane Jesus Church, which is Lutheran, of course. The Place of Jesus is the name of that church, born under persecution. And the old patriarch of a pastor who was officiating in the service in the Amharic language was very close to Hebrew. Many words are very similar to the Hebrew words like kadosh, holy, and so on, aretz, earth. It was marched 365 miles on foot at the time when he was taken under arrest because of the fact that he was professing the Lutheran faith. Coming out of an experience like that, you become well aware of something that a noted journalist who was raised here in this state said to me, that he had to become aware of the fact that the world is bigger than Missouri. And if that is true of Missouri as a state, it is also true of Missouri as a state of mind. This sermon was interpreted for me by Otto Emmanuel Selassie, who was counselor of the British Embassy in London, who with this aged patriarch founded this congregation after the tribulations with the Italians from 1935 to 1940 and 41. And the scriptures were read at that service by His Excellency Otto Emmanuel Abraham, who is Minister of Postal Services, Telephone and Telegraph of the Imperial Ethiopian Government. One of the men in attendance was a man who had been in my home a number of times in New York, Mr. Gabriab, who is an educational consultant to the Imperial Ethiopian Government and now under loan to the American Lutheran Mission in Ethiopia for 2 years. It will give you some idea of the stature of this group. And it was very interesting to see that about half of the audience could understand English. For at one point, there was something that was just a little bit out of the ordinary, and half of the audience laughed, and the other half laughed when the interpreter finally got it across. We are coming of age when we begin to realize that the world is bigger than Missouri. Some people, as Professor Schuller pointed out this morning, are frightened to death about the fact that change has occurred in the world. They would like to believe that there has been none. They are like those people who wouldn't believe that there was a steam engine when it went right by them during the last century. And there are, I'm afraid, quite a few of those among us. There may be some here this morning. And then there are those who, because there has been change, are ready to throw out everything that has happened in the past, to cast out the baby with the bath, as if there were nothing of value that had ever happened before our time. And we've got some of those too. Probably not as many proportionately as some other church bodies do, but we've got them also. And I think Professor Schuller emphasized something that's very, very important to know. And that is that whatever the eyes of the church may light upon in the future, there's always one great fact that never will change in the life of the church, and that is the cross of Christ, which has been erected by God at the crossroads of history, and indeed much closer to the area that I'm talking about this morning than we are at this moment. When you get to a place like Ethiopia, which is 1,700 miles or so from Cairo into Africa, and you haven't yet got to the center of Africa, you become aware of the fact that this is the historic territory near Aksum from which the Queen of Sheba made her journey to visit Solomon just because she'd heard about him, that's all. This curiosity, intellectual and religious, which caused somebody to make a trip like that in the days of the ox cart, is simply fabulous. Why, you can hardly make it by plane today. The emperor had one of the two jet planes, by the way, on his journey. He was in Morocco at the time, so all the schedules were rearranged with the other jet plane so he could get down into that territory. And get out again, too, by the way. Oh, this is the continent that gave to the world St. Augustine. And that where St. Athanasius did his work. This is the place to which traditionally St. Mark came and made his first convert, Ananias, about 40 AD, very soon after the crucifixion and the resurrection. Somebody has called Africa the sleeping giant. And that might be another similarity to what some people have said about our own church body. It's also a great sleeping giant. You can take all of the United States of America, all of Western Europe, all of China, and all of India, and you can put it on the map of Africa, and you're still going to have room left over. This is the tremendous territory we are talking about. It's a rich territory, so rich that nobody knows exactly how wealthy it really is. And it is in transition, a new day, when people are coming straight out of the Stone Age and are rushing into the 20th century. This again is appalling to some people and tremendously exhilarating to others, but it is actually happening right before your eyes. The people in Ethiopia are not going to be living in the same way 2 years from now as they are living today. And they are not living today as they were 2 years ago. This is how fast things are happening in Africa. You can write it off and you can try to laugh it off too. But it's happening right here and now. Actually, it's happening in an area that's very, very old. There are few written records, of course, except in Egypt and in Ethiopia. But that continent has a history that goes back at least 5,000 years. Very little archaeology, for that matter, to tell you anything about it. But the people who live there are proud of being African. And if they have any great problem, it is that in this great rush forward, they are depending so much on slogans which have so very often so little to do with reality. In that respect, too, they may be similar to our own history. There are two Africas. One is the one north of the Sahara, and the other is the one south of the Sahara. In fact, the people who live south of the Sahara wonder whether that is Africa, north of the Sahara, and I wonder it myself. When you stop at Cairo, for example, you feel as if you are more in the Middle East than you are in Africa. And I imagine that's true of the whole Berber land across the northern part of Africa, although I've never been there and I'm not too well acquainted with that part of the continent. I'm not too well acquainted with any part of it, for that matter. I'm very much like that woman who took a trip to Europe and had to omit the chapter on Belgium because she was sick that day. I don't speak from any great acquaintance with the continent itself, but I did have the opportunity during this last week to meet with people who are well acquainted with the whole continent of Africa and with Ceylon and India too at the same time. For I was there at the first meeting of the studio managers associated with the new radio project in Ethiopia, which was a great deal more extensive than I had ever imagined it would be, although we are an integral part of this project. I was asked to come there in order to lay a theological base for the operation of this great station, which is even now a building. And I want to say that the men that came from this seminary and represented their areas at this meeting made probably the greatest contributions to the whole project, whether it was from the theological or from the technical and professional point of view. I was genuinely proud of those men, and I don't have to go ahead and name them at this moment. They were in a company of people who knew what they are doing in the area of mass communications in the Near East, India, Ceylon, South Africa, West Africa, and all over this great territory. These men knew their people, and they knew how to get at them through the mass means that are at their disposal. The station actually is broadcasting in 12 languages at the present time, and that's quite a feat when you think about it, that it went on the air in February of this year. These men were ironing out, of course, problems that have arisen in this time. But these programs are being prepared in the areas where the languages are spoken to be broadcast by this station back to those areas. And in some cases, it's the only way that we can reach it, places like Ceylon and India today, South Africa too, for that matter. There are 700 languages in Africa. Just think about that. And then there are those colonies that speak French because they are French dominated, and English because they were English dominated, and Portuguese and Spanish because the Portuguese and Spanish had them or have them. And then there are two great African languages that swing their way across that continent, Swahili, and it's significant that that is one of the first languages in which the Lutheran Hour has been broadcast in Africa, prepared right in Tanganyika, where the language has its center. And then Hausa, which we are preparing to broadcast now, that's kind of a global Arabic, which is spoken all the way across Africa and Nigeria, too. It's a continent in which people feel lost. And I'm not talking about the white people now who've come there, but the people who've been there all these years. The old civilization of the witch doctor is on its way out, and individualism, to which these people have not been accustomed, is on its way in. And they feel lost, these people who have been used to group living, group thinking, group decisions, and group religion, too, at the same time. This is most true of the cities. And the same thing is happening in Africa that is happening in our own country. People are leaving the agricultural areas and moving toward the cities. Industrialization is beginning there. And it's going to come a lot faster than it did in countries like our own, where it developed quite naturally. In fact, we have a pattern here that I think might be taken from a place like Alaska, where the railroads have almost been entirely skipped in the transportation development of that country, and they jumped right from the dog sled to the airplane. This is what's happening in Africa. Incidentally, it is a significant fact to me that of all the places in Africa where the church is the weakest, is in the cities. Right in the place where all of this is happening, and where the message of the church might have its greatest effect immediately. The church has done most of its work in the rural areas. Group ideologies have a special appeal to people in this situation, and I think you know what I'm talking about. Something like communism has a certain attractiveness to people who feel lost in the great cities. And that brings me to the political situation, where the witch doctor is still strong in the villages, where he's lost out and losing out in the cities, where many villages still have the same pattern that they had 100 years ago, but where the pattern is totally destroyed in the cities. Democracy is a very difficult thing to introduce. And it's complicated by the fact that the astounding rate of illiteracy in Africa. Indeed, it's taken the jump there too. That's why radios are terribly important in a continent like this. To bring these new ideas to people, you can't do it through the old ways of first educating them to read and then educating them to think about these things. They're thinking about them already, and if you're going to reach them, you'll have to reach them by means of the spoken word.
You're not going to be able to do it on the printed page.
Rates of illiteracy are simply fabulous. Most of the countries of Africa have rates of illiteracy that go down to 1% and 2%. There are very few that go up any higher. In fact, there are only two countries in all of Africa that give their children more than an elementary education. There are only two countries that give more than 10% of their children a secondary education, and those are Ghana and Egypt.
Significant that both of those countries
are within the Soviet orbit at the present time. Most of the countries that are in the orbit of the West haven't got any more than 1% or 2% of their children going into secondary schools, and very many of them haven't got more than 10% into elementary schools. A fluid political situation, therefore, has developed. And I would say that this is more due to the preaching of the missionaries than it is to the scientific influence of the hypothesis of the Soviet Union. And yet the Soviet Union is capitalizing on what the missionaries have produced by the propaganda, number one, that they are using science for the benefit of all and not just for the rich. And number two, that they do stress the old group living idea. And three, that an ideology becomes a very easy substitute for the old faith when it is discarded. And I'm not talking about the Christian faith, but the old primitive animistic faith of these countries. There's much more Christian influence on politics in Africa than there is in any other place that I've noticed in the world.
The political participation of the Coptic Church, for example, in Ethiopia is very significant. And in Tanganyika and in Nigeria and many of the other countries, the leaders have been educated by the missionary schools, and they have not repudiated their education as many of the leaders of the Congo did when that country became independent. I would say this, that the political influence of Christianity has been both good and bad in Africa. And one cannot describe this as simply a black and white situation. But here we have 55 countries, 31 of which have become independent in the last decade. When you think back to 1914, beginning of World War I, there were only 3 countries in all of Africa that were independent. In 1950, that is at the halfway point in this century, only one new nation had been added to those independent countries. Of the four in 1950, there were Liberia, Union of South Africa, Egypt, and Ethiopia. And Ethiopia, by the way, has been independent for over 1,000 years. The only reason for that is way up in the mountains there. Addis Ababa is 1,000 feet up in the air, 8,000 feet up in the air, has a climate very much like St. Louis, which, of course, is not exactly something to brag about, but nevertheless. But since 1950, you've got 27 new countries. A race is on in Africa. It's a political race. And I guess it's a religious one, too. is quite different from the situation that you have here in our country. Now, Professor Schuller described the situation in our country and in the Western world this morning when he talked to you about the secularism, which has made it possible for people to live a perfectly satisfactory life without God. We can get along without him. Why doesn't he leave us alone? And that kind of thing. But you don't have that situation in Africa. Supernatural takes its normal place in life in Africa. And you don't have to worry too much about secularism. That's one reason that communism is going to have trouble in Africa, because the African mind is not quite congenial to the whole secular point of view
that lies at the base of Marxism and communism.
There are 240 million people there in Africa. Remember how tremendous it was? That's not many more people than we have in the United States. You can just imagine how sparse the population is in very many places in Africa. You can fly for 500 miles and not see a single human habitation in the northern part of Ethiopia.
Of those 240 million people, 86 million are Muslims. 55 are adherents of primitive religion. 35 are Christians, and that's quite a significant figure.
And 44 or so are nothing at all. Islam, you see, has made tremendous progress in Africa, has it not? Why? Well, that's a question a lot of people have asked themselves. Kenneth Craig has written a very fine book on this subject. He was associated with the Near East Christian Council for 2 years.
What was it called? Something about sandals. Do you remember that? What's that? Sandals at the mosque. That's right. Sandals at the mosque. Well, that's about it penetrating an analysis of Islam and its appeal, as I have read anywhere. And it seems to me that he makes the point that Islam's appeal is simplicity. And it could very well be that Christianity has been made all too difficult, especially by the missionaries who've come from the Western world.
I spoke for an hour and a half on nothing but theology and answered an hour and 45 minutes worth of questions. And then an Ethiopian got up. He walked up to the platform here, and he made a statement with which the whole audience there agreed, and they all knew what he was talking about. And he said, the problem with the Christian gospel in Africa is not only the natural hostility of men to the gospel, but it is also the fact that the missionaries get in the way of the gospel. And they all shook their heads yes. There was proof. And then he sat down. And he said this without rancor of any sort, just as a plain statement of fact. And I think I know what he's talking about. The missionaries are more interested in some cases in what the mission board back home is thinking about them than they are in what those people are thinking to whom they are reaching out with the gospel. And I think one of the big problems here is polygamy, especially in an area like Nigeria. I see no reason why any missionary has to justify his policy on how he handles a chief who's got six wives to somebody back in the United States. It's more important that he justify this to the people there. And I don't see any reason, for that matter, if he wants to, and I'm not going to tell him what to do, that he is willing to deal with this situation on a basis that will take some amount of time and not make this chief give up five of those six wives before he is able to confess his faith in Jesus Christ. I don't read it that way in the gospel. And the fact of the matter is, one of the missionaries told me himself that a chief got the idea that the missionary wanted one of those wives. That's why. We are dealing with people who live as a group, you see. And it's very important that that chief who believes in Christ is able to confess his faith in Christ and join the fellowship of the faith. And I don't see why dumping those five women out on the street to become prostitutes isn't a special feather in the hat of Christianity. I read the Old Testament a little differently from that whole thing. As I say, I'm not the one to decide this issue for Africans, but it's important that these problems be settled in the context of Africa and not in the context of the morality of the United States, and the Western world. Now, don't let anybody misunderstand me and somebody go away here and say, Dr. Hoffman came out in favor of polygamy here at this point. I'm quite sure that the ideal Christian situation is monogamy. I'm sure of that. And I'm sure it'll come to that, too, in Africa, as Christianity makes its way. But these special problems that the church has at the moment will have to be settled in an African way. This is the simplicity that the gospel needs and the love which goes along with that simplicity. And if we're going to counter the simplicity of Islam. Half of Africa is living in a vacuum, and the missionary opportunity there is simply tremendous at this moment.
New ways, new approaches are needed by the Christian church, and they will have to be decided upon there and not here. The old days of the fuzzy-wuzzies is over. This is the way we used to refer to them. Incidentally, I heard one of our radio programs from Nigeria over the station while I was there. And it was a little drama in which there were three animals that Africans love animal stories. And they were Fuzzy, Wuzzy, and Buzzy. And as they came over, they were Foozy, Woozy, and Boozy. They didn't want to change that. That's the way they want to pronounce it. Okay, let them go ahead. Notice it was in English. English is a lingua franca all over the world. Let's not write this off. I don't say that we don't have to learn those languages, but it's important that we realize that language is not quite the factor that it used to be in reaching people with the gospel. What are the problems there? Well, let me list them. One, I mean the problems in the church. One is lack of maturity among the laymen of the church. Well, that isn't restricted to Africa. Two is confusion regarding the proper use of the Bible. By the way, that's not restricted to Africa. Although they have superstitious uses of the Bible there, which I think would not be very common in our part of the world. And three is sectarianism. And I guess that's not restricted to Africa either. 2,000 Christian sects working in Africa, and some of them very irresponsibly. A missionary from Ceylon, of a Reformed church who had been associated with the Back to the Bible broadcast theater, EP, in Lincoln, and I refer to that only because I will give you an idea of his theological orientation, which is very, very fundamentalistic, I want you to know. This is the man who was telling me about the seven Assembly of God missionaries came into Ceylon. They stayed for 2 years. They never bothered to learn the language. They went back and they told about the magnificent victories that they won for Christ, and all they had left was a tragedy behind them, a debacle, which would take years to pick up. I want you to know that our missionaries act most responsibly overseas. I've noticed this in every place I've been, and Philippines, everywhere else. They deal with great Christian courtesy with their fellow missionaries from other denominations. They're very loyal to the truth and very loyal to our church. And by the way, I don't think that any of us has to create a mythology of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to justify its existence on these fields. There's plenty of reason for us to be in all of the places that I have seen. There's a loyal confession of our church, which I think is very impressive to the other Christian denominations, and especially when it is carried out in this reverent spirit, which I have noticed in our missionaries. That's one thing for which I am very grateful among the men that I have seen. But I do believe that we're going to have a new day among all of these missionaries, where a new attack will have to be made on the whole problem within the context of the countries in which they are working. And I say this with the executive of the Board for Foreign Missions present here, because he's probably more aware of it even than I am. There will have to be less direction here and more help and support from here than there has ever been in the past.
We are going to have to let these men make decisions which we may not even understand altogether here at home. And we're going to have the confidence in them that we will support them to the hilt in the decisions that they make over there. They're going to make some mistakes. But who are we to talk about mistakes? We made them too. And indeed, this is the way the church progresses. It has to make its mistakes and then not make them again. This is the way experience is built. And we're going to have to depend on these men, young and old, whom we send abroad to do that. What's needed in the church abroad? Number one, theologians are needed over there. Not theologians who sit on their pants and repeat what they found in Pieper here. And don't let anybody go home and say Dr. Hoffman was against Pieper. We need theologians who are going to take the Christian message right out of the New Testament, hot off the anvil, and state it in the context, let us say now, of Africa. Next, we're going to have to train pastors and teachers as we've never trained them before. And third, we're going to have to build strong congregations, not around Americans, but around the Africans who have to do that work. And then number four, we're going to have to reach the masses that we've never reached them before. It was Ed Lydon, who's now in charge of the Near East Christian Council, but was at that time with Rabenko when he talked to me about this, who was telling me about his missionary work in Iran. I believe he's a Reformed man, too. And he was telling me that normally they reached about 40 people in a year's time in their whole mission work. That's very tough in a Muslim country. They went on the radio, and in the first year they reached 17,000. And they began to knock on doors, and people knew them where they hadn't known them before. I don't think this is the only way to do things, but we've got to reach those masses of people, and not just the elite along the way. What's needed in the church is leadership, guidance, and evangelism. I omitted stewardship. That's something that I'm not prepared to talk about. I don't know how to tell these people to carry out the stewardship of life. That's something they're going to have to develop themselves. I think we've made a great mistake in trying to translate methods that we've developed here for good stewardship into foreign lands. But evangelism, that's something we can talk to them about. Indeed, as I was on the plane back home to go up to Cairo, there was a fellow with me on the plane from this meeting who was getting off at Asmara, Eritrea, a former Italian colony, and was going to travel over to Khartoum, the capital of the Sudan, where we had landed on the way down. This is in the desert down there, a city built right out of that desert. He was going to talk to these people in the Sudan about preparing tapes and everything else to be broadcast on the station, and he was saying that when the new republic of Sudan, was organized, the second piece of legislation was a Missionary Control Act. The very second thing. By the way, when these Africans talk about lack of freedom in South Africa and walk out of the General Assembly when the representative of South Africa starts to speak, they are not doing themselves a favor, because they get people to look at them too. The second act of Sudan was a Missionary Control Act, which is applied differently in the northern part of Sudan from what it is in the southern part.
In the northern part, they wink at a lot of it.
In the southern part, a missionary can't stir out of his compound without having the government on him. Now, what happens? These people become closed in. They become hesitant to move out. They don't even ask whether they can evangelize in the territory. They just take for granted they can. And that's a mistake, too. This is where we have to encourage people under pressure to move out anyway. It may be at the price of suffering. And it's awfully hard to counsel people to suffer for the sake of the gospel. But we have to suffer with them, too, at the same time. And here, finally, these people had got the government to agree that they could prepare tapes, and he was going in, and he didn't even know whether he'd be able to take the tapes out after they were prepared. But they were beginning to move into the area of evangelism. And then, of course, education. The vastness of the educational problem is almost beyond belief in Africa. And the missionary influence on the schools is going to diminish as time goes on. Most of the missionary schools in Africa have been supported by government money, and at the very first opportunity, these new independent governments are going to take over the schools. I might say there's a little parable for our own country, of which we ought to be aware when these sentimentalists tell us that you can accept federal funds for support of our parochial school system without any controls being exercised whatsoever. That's sheer baloney. And Africa is the finest example of it. They're going to take over our schools in Nigeria, whether we like it or not, because we've been accepting government money all these years, even though the Wisconsin Synod has been an integral part of this proposition and has always used this shibboleth, mixing church and state. They forgot about it over in Nigeria. And we're going to pay the price for that over there. The schools are going to be taken over by the government. Of course, that's probably the way it'll have to be, because no church is able to educate the whole citizenry of the country. We aren't able to do it here, and they wouldn't be able to do it there either. They will have to accommodate themselves to that situation. Another problem that the church meets in Africa is race relations, although it's probably not as great a problem there as it is here in the United States. There are less than 10 million white people in all of Africa. What's that, 1/24? Somebody has put the figure at 6 million white people in the whole continent of Africa. Well, there's not going to be too much discrimination that way. And some remarkable things are taking place. One of the missionaries from Tanganyika, a very fine young man, was telling me how he and seven others, when they were in the airport, when they were hauled in by a police commissioner and given a terrible tongue lashing because they hadn't stood up when the Tanganyika National Anthem was being played way out at a plane there, about 200 feet away from the airport. They hadn't even noticed that it was being played. And he felt just sick about it, he said, literally, physically sick. And he began to wonder whether it was worthwhile to be a missionary in a place like this. And it was about 2 weeks later that President Nyerere of Tanganyika issued a proclamation that I read about in the New York Times that I didn't understand at the moment, which he criticized officials of the Tanganyika government for using the national anthem as a device in order to get people under their thumb. He said, that's not the way we play the national anthem here in Tanganyika. And he went on to just pull the rug right out from under this kind of brutal tactic. You heard of Kenyatta, who was head of the Mau Mau in Kenya, and the conferences that just took place in London this last week. By the way, one of the men from this conference that I was attending went home because he heard that Kenyatta was on his way back from London, and he expected disorders in Kenya, and his family was there alone, and he said, that's my first obligation. And we said, yes, it is, you go. As it happened, Kenyatta was going home to still disquiet within his own party and to explain the situation so he could go back to London and sign the agreement with the British government, and I was told what happened there on the highlands with those white British farmers
who for so long held these Mau Mau people under their heels and now feared what retaliation would mean to them.
And I guess you've read books like Uhuru by Robert Ruark, and you know of the brutal situation that has existed there in Kenya. Kenyatta got up in a meeting of these white British farmers,
and he said,
I have done many wrongs and I ask to be forgiven. And he said, we will forgive you all the wrongs that you have done, and we are going to start out now and build a new state. This was the theme of his talk. And when he finished, these white farmers got up and they held up their fists and they said, Harambe, which was the battle cry of the Mau Mau. Freedom. This is the new Africa that we're talking about. It's an Africa that has a heritage of French domination, where there was very little racial discrimination, but where there was very little justice, too, for that matter, and very little regard for human rights. We've had an Africa, part of which has been under Spanish or Portuguese
domination,
where the people who were educated and had become a little different were promoted to the clan of the Portuguese and the Spanish people. And then we have the English areas where education was the watchword and good administration. There may have been some discrimination, but where people were probably prepared better for independence than any other place. And then the Belgians, where also there was no racial discrimination, where the only interest was to make people economically happy. And where, when the Belgians moved out, there were only 12 educated Congolese in their whole vast area to take over the duties of government. And then there's South Africa, which is a real sore spot in Africa today. And where this policy of apartheid, brutally enforced, is identified with Christianity. This is something that all of us are going to have to face.
There are two mistakes, it seems to me, that people make in Africa when they go there from here. One is to despise color, and the other is to make color a king. It seems to me that we've got to do what we have to do here, and that is to treat color as one is an unimportant factor in the life of man. Not only to be colorblind ourselves, but to help people forget about color. I know that's what we did in our own parish in New York City. We never once had a discussion on human relations. Never once. But when the first Negro woman came to be confirmed, no questions were asked whether or not this is the Holy Spirit working and we have to accept His work. Not reluctantly either. We just do this because it's part of His great glory in this world that He calls those whom you call. All who call on the name of the Lord shall be saved, no matter what their class, condition, or color. The last little thing that my daughter, who was 8 years old, did before we left New York was to go to a birthday party in Harlem. She was one of two little white girls there. The rest were all Negro girls with beautifully arranged party. And she was invited because she was the first friend that little Lorna had when she came to our parochial school, 30% of whose pupils were Negro pupils. This is the way we have to go to Africa, too. Without any regard for these things that people seem to think so important. We have to be aware of the changing climate of Africa and help people over the hump of industrialization, to help them to live as a group the way they're accustomed to live, and at the same time to espouse the faith of Christ. Incidentally, in Ethiopia, they told me that 27 witch doctors in the last 3 years have become Christians, and the whole village has become Christian with them. These are Ethiopians doing this. And then we must not forget the women. It was Dr. Agri of Ghana at the All-Africa Conference in 1961, and by the way, that was quite a conference, held there at Addis Ababa in that great hall, which they point to very proudly. The emperor of Ethiopia, the Lion of Judah and whatever else he is, took his suitcase and went over to the hotel and stayed there with the delegates at the conference. Very impressive fact to everybody. This woman got up and she said, "You educate a man and you educate a man. You educate a woman and you educate a nation." And there is something to this. The Africans are very well aware of it, and we must be too. There are problems of morality which the Christian faith will have to face. In South Africa, I'm told that 80 to 85% of the children are born out of wedlock. This is a special problem the government of South Africa has. And as one of our responsible newspapers pointed out the other day, the Africans who walked out of that assembly meeting at the UN did themselves no good. Because if you can't listen to a reasoned appeal from a man who's opposed to you, there's something wrong with your position. Now, I don't believe in the position of South Africa, but the problems of Africa are not going to be solved by walking out of meetings where the other fellow talks. One of the problems of Africa is that Africans are set against Asians and Africans are set against Africans. Witness Morocco and Algeria. And it was a very interesting thing that while I was in Ethiopia, the star football player of Ethiopia had his leg broken in a very rough game with the football team of Kenya. This is, of course, their soccer type of football. Italo was his name. Would you believe it? When the director general of athletics of Ethiopia came back,
he blamed the whole thing on the white population of Kenya. Although there wasn't a white man on the team, wasn't a white man directing the team or anything else, this is the popular propaganda that's going around. There's nothing wrong with us Africans. It's just some outside agitators that are coming in here and causing all this trouble. Now, where did we hear that before? I might say about radio in Africa that it has come to stay. Television probably will never make the dent in Africa that's made here because of the wide distances involved and the lack of opportunity to build that kind of station. This tremendous expanse that we have, for example, has been in this installation put in there with that idea in view. I asked one of the missionaries, what do you have to say to young fellows that I'm going to address in St. Louis next week?
This is not a Missouri Synod missionary, not a Lutheran either, for that matter.
This is what he said. He wrote this out for me. He said, I'm sorry, I didn't have any typewriter.
He said, be sure of the Lord's call. Two, a good wife is most desirable and essential. After all, a family is the most common unit in all the world. I believe a missionary is more effective with one. Husband and wife must jointly accept the call to mission service. Both should be missionaries. Simply being a good wife and mother can be of tremendous help and an example the value of which it is difficult to measure. There will be many opportunities for direct mission work for the wife too, as she is able.
Sunday school
teacher training, vacation, church school, and so forth. And I might say, as far as that is concerned, women have an insight into affairs that men very often do not have. That's why I let a woman pick all the questions that are answered on the Lutheran Hour, and even to suggest a way in which they might be answered. Three, the missionary should be one who can quickly adapt to new surroundings and situations. Four, he must be able to quickly evaluate situations which are very strange and different. Five, though equipment is necessary, the missionary should possess his possessions and not be possessed by them. And six, finally, the infit is more important than the outfit. He must have learned to find himself spiritually. He must not be quarrelsome, fighting, and contending. Instead, he must be mild-tempered, kindly to everyone. The man who is saying this is a man who is thoroughly saturated in the scriptures and the one way over on the right wing of fundamentalist Christianity. There's no liberal talking here. Pursuing the bond of peace.
He must be a skilled and suitable teacher, patient and forbearing, willing to suffer wrong. He must correct his opponents with courtesy and gentleness, in hope that God may grant them repentance, and that having repented, they will come to know the truth and have life.
He must walk softly, speak tenderly, pray fervently.
I think we should allow a little bit of time.
Sorry, I'm not qualified to answer that question.
I think maybe you know more about it than I do. Any other questions? I don't want to brush off the question, but I just don't know about that sort of thing.